This week, Hurricane Ida took the lives of at least 60 people across 8 states, and that includes 11 New Yorkers in basement apartments in Queens who died from horrific flash flooding. In Louisiana, some may have to wait 6 weeks for power. It's all raised a lot of pressing questions about climate change, unpredictability of our weather, and how to plan for it. Let's talk to Alice Hill, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. She worked on climate resilience in the Obama White House, and her book is The Fight for Climate After COVID-19. Alice, welcome.
Thank you. So glad to join you.
Now, we are seeing extreme events across the map. Just in the U.S., we have flooding in New York, and we had it in Michigan earlier this year, power and water out in the south on the Gulf Coast, and fires across the western part of the country. With all these fancy climate and weather tools we have, why are these specific events in specific places still so hard to forecast?
Well, it's very hard to model specific events. That's one of the challenges we have with our understanding of the climate. We have a much better understanding of the broad trends, but when you get down to the specific, will a storm hit this location on this date with this much rain, it's really hard to predict, and it takes a lot of computing power, and we just haven't invested as deeply in that yet.
Now, in towns and cities across the country, I mean, we're learning big questions about how we live and who lives where, right? I mean, we have an idea who might live in a low cut-rate basement apartment in Queens. So often this seems to strike those who are the least well-off, yeah?
Absolutely. This hits the poor because they often are living in accommodations, or people of color have been in areas that have been redlined, which it turns out are more prone to disasters, those particular areas. And then, of course, the disabled have a harder time evacuating during an event, as do the elderly, children, and sometimes in many countries, women also have a harder time during these really extreme weather events that cause harm.
Mm. Now, in your book, you write about being more resilient going forward in specific places, not just to the broad climate models. How do policymakers, all of us, even start to tackle this question of being more resilient, given right our cities have kind of grown up over hundreds of years and we kind of live where we live?
Well, you point out an excellent point, because our cities have been developed, but they've been developed on an assumption that the climate will remain stable. The climate is no longer stable, and as that changes, some of the choices we've already made don't look so good. And it's very important that as we make choices about where and how we live going forward, we account for this risk. But right now, we have more Americans moving into areas of risk than not, and we need to change that for us to be safe.
And what's at the top of your list, I guess, for policy prescriptions to address this? I mean, this is a long-term challenge here.
Absolutely. And I think the place we need to start, which is very basic, is we need a national adaptation plan. We don't have one. And that means that we have a sort of a piecemeal or a sprinkling of projects designed to address these risks. But overall, if you step back and you think, will this really add up to making the United States safer in the future? It's a real risk that it won't. The Government Accountability Office, which is the watchdog for the federal government, has pointed out repeatedly that without a national plan, we are at risk of not prioritizing the right investments and continuing to see communities being bailed out after disaster rather than investing in risk reduction in advance, which can save us a whole lot of money.
Now, in your writing, your new book, you have drawn a parallel to COVID-19, that the same way we have fought the pandemic to protect vulnerable people, we need to look at climate change impacts kind of the same way. What are the connections here?
Well, it's a catastrophic risk. That is the pandemic, but it's shown the rest of the world, all of us, what a catastrophic risk can do. It's also taught us what we can do about it. So that would be we can create safety nets that allow for the most vulnerable to be better prepared for these events. We can stockpile goods and be prepared to surge as we see compounding, consecutive, very damaging events occurring at once. You know, a friend of mine at FEMA told me they just never planned to have to respond to all 50 states and six territories at once with the pandemic, much less with these wildfires and other things.
Okay. Well, that is Alice Hill, Senior Fellow for Energy and Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. Alice, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Let's look more closely at another signal of climate change in the Great Lakes. Toxic algae is a problem in some of the lakes. It's usually caused by warm temperatures and agricultural runoff. But Lake Superior is cold and deep and surrounded by forests, not fields. This summer, scientists are trying to figure out why sporadic blooms have appeared on the lake's southern shore and whether they can keep the blooms from growing. From member station WUWM, Susan Bentz has the story.